everyone. I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. And boy, are we in for a treat today. My guest is Dr. Ryan Martin, also known as the Anger Professor. He's a distinguished researcher and author specializing in the study of anger and other emotions. His work delves into both healthy and unhealthy expressions of anger, offering insights into why people become angry and how they can channel this emotion productively. His work is regularly featured in the media. He's also the Dean of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, a TED speaker, and author of two books, How to Deal with Angry People and Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change, which offer practical strategies for using anger constructively and how to effectively manage interactions with angry individuals. Welcome, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's great to see you again, and I'm looking forward to talking about this.
Fantastic. I also am really excited that we're talking today because anger is something every single person in the world experiences. Mm-hmm. And when we hear about anger, it's usually within a negative context. In fact, in your first book, Why We Get Mad, you write, anger can destroy lives, anger can end in destroyed relationships, but it doesn't have to do these things. In fact, anger can be used for good. Anger can motivate people to solve problems or to create art and write literature. What matters most is not necessarily how mad you are, but what you do with that anger. In other words, anger can also be a powerful force for good, as the subtitle points out. Yet at the beginning, you also say that you routinely find that people do not know or understand what anger is. So while later on, we're going to talk a little bit about the positive effects of anger, I first want to create an understanding of what anger actually is.
Yeah. So, you know, I think a lot of times what people think is that anger is that outward expression, right? The yelling, the screaming, the swearing, the physical aggression that can sometimes happen. And that is, of course, related to anger. But what anger is purely just the emotional response. It is, and so to even break it down further than that, let's define what an emotional response is. It's basically the psychological experience that includes a physiological arousal. It includes the thoughts you have in that particular moment. And then it involves what sometimes people refer to as behaviors. I'm actually going to call them, just to get really, you know, scientific, action tendencies. And why I like that phrasing is that action tendency says there are things you want to do, right? There's a tendency to engage in these behaviors, but you don't have to. And I think that's really important when we think about anger. So as an emotion, how do those three things kind of manifest themselves? So the physiological arousal is usually pretty obvious to people. That's the heart rate increasing, the muscle tension. It's ultimately that fight or flight system, your sympathetic nervous system kicking in, and you getting you feeling all of those things. Mm-hmm. Then there's the thoughts, and typically when we're angry, we have thoughts connected to fairness or injustice. We have thoughts connected to, like, they shouldn't have done that. Maybe thoughts related to revenge. So it's these thoughts of having been wronged or harmed or had your goals blocked in some way. And then the action tendency, and this is, I think, why some people get a little bit confused. The action tendency is the desire to lash out. Typically, in fact, in a lot of ways, you could define anger as the emotional desire to lash out.
That's really interesting.
But that, I think the key is you don't have to do that. And oftentimes, maybe even the majority of time, when people are angry, they don't. Right? When people get angry, they hold it in, they channel it into other things, and so on.
So you described anger, and you also say somewhere in your work that it's not secondary to other things or other emotions. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that? Because we often associate anger with, I don't know, frustration or sadness or who knows what, but you're saying we really need to think about all of that a little bit differently.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that anger, so I think where some people get a little bit, where I disagree with a lot of people out there, is that people will say anger is secondary, is a secondary emotion. and that it's always when people are angry, they're really scared, they're really sad, or they're really feeling something else. And I guess the way I would describe it is that it can be a secondary emotion, but it isn't always a secondary emotion. And what I mean by that is there are times when your anger is rooted in feeling sad or feeling hurt or feeling scared. But there are also times where your anger is simply rooted in you having experienced an injustice, or you having been treated poorly, or you having your goals blocked. And if I could take it even a step further, one of the reasons this bugs me, this belief of anger as always being secondary, is it actually feels really minimizing to people who are angry. That there are people who experience legitimate injustice, and for us to tell them, well, no, you're just sad, or you're just hurt, that actually feels really minimizing to people who have experienced that injustice, where anger is a totally appropriate emotion and a totally appropriate emotional response.
No, that's fascinating. And I do want to touch on injustice a little bit later in our conversation. Mm-hmm. That's really good. But I want to just tap into briefly what you call the why we get mad model in your work. And it has four components, I believe. Can you walk us through that? And then also combine that with how anger might be directed at another person or a situation or oneself, if it differs in how the model is applied.
Yeah. So I'll start by saying that I think if there's a thing I talk about that I believe to be most important, it is probably this. And that is because, you know, so often people think that anger is caused by a particular thing and only that thing. They say, well, I got mad because, or it made me so mad when. And yes, that can be true. There are times where there's just a specific thing that really was going to lead to anger no matter what. But more often than not, anger and any emotion emerges through sort of a confluence of stuff, right? And starting with some sort of precipitant, some sort of what we might call a trigger or a provocation or something like that. It's a thing that happens. And I'm going to, you know, for me, I'll just use the example, like I'm driving to work and I'm running a little bit late and I'm coming up on a yellow light. And I think to myself, I can make it through that light. That's no problem. And then the car in front of me decides to stop for the light, even though from my perspective, they didn't need to. Right. So that's the precipitant. It's a thing that happened and I get angry about it. Now, you could argue, OK, so this is a person blocking my goals. This is a person, you know, probably not treating me unfairly or treating me, you know, badly, but certainly blocking my goals. So that's the precipitant. But there's other parts of that scenario that are relevant. And that brings us to another piece here, which is the pre-anger state. And so the pre-anger state is the mood we are in at the time of that precipitant. Mm-hmm. And I'm defining mood broadly here to include everything from, am I anxious or scared or sad or anything like that? But also, am I hungry? Am I fatigued? Am I physically uncomfortable? Am I too hot or too cold? You know, all these other sort of physiological states that could influence how I respond to that. But also even sort of what the emotional circumstances are at the moment. In the example I described, I'm going to get way angrier if I'm running late for something than if I'm just out for a Sunday drive and I'm not in a hurry, right? That changes the nature of my sort of physiological or my current mood. So then that third piece is that appraisal process, right? It's how we judge or how we evaluate that person's behavior. And so in the example I just gave, I could look at it a couple of ways. I could say, he shouldn't have done that. I could say, you know, this is going to ruin my entire day or my entire week, or this is going to make me late for work. I can focus on all that. Or I could say, okay, that person is just a little more cautious than me. It's not a big deal. And in the latter example there, I'm not going to get as angry. I might still think, they didn't need to do that, but I'm not going to blow it out of proportion and get as angry as I would have.
When you think of how people express anger, three general approaches come to mind, at least among the lay public, and that's the non-confrontational passive-aggressive way, the open-aggressive way, which we see in movies a lot, right? It makes for very interesting drama that can range from arguing to shouting and physical altercations to assertive anger, which involves acknowledging your feelings and trying to constructively address the situation. Is that correct? Is that what you found in your research?
Yeah, you know, for a long time, we would kind of categorize these into three or four different categories. We had anger expression out, which is, I think, what you were describing. It's like, you know, the oftentimes physical violence, but yelling, that sort of thing. Anger expression in, which is sort of anger suppression. It's holding it in. This could include some of those passive aggressive approaches that you're describing. And then we had anger control. And anger control was sort of there. That was broken into two categories as well. I don't think those two categories are quite as meaningful. But this is the idea of you want to express it, but you decide to you're controlling your emotional responses so that you can do it in a more assertive way. This is also includes like deep breathing and grounding and some of those approaches as well. I think over time, we've expanded that a little bit to think more about other ways that people channel their anger. I still think those categories hold, but when you think about like within each category, there's sort of other categories, right? And so I can assert myself when I'm angry, the way you described. I could also write poetry. I could also write letters to the editor, which is sort of a form of assertion. I could create music. I could protest. You know, there's all of these different ways that people can sort of, I can problem solve. That's a biggie for me, is like thinking, okay, so what's the problem here and how do I solve it? And so we can ultimately, there's near infinite expressions when we get angry, and some of them are good for us. Some of them are bad for us. Most of the time it's really contextual. What should we do, quote unquote, in a particular moment really depends on the context and the circumstances.
I guess what we're talking about is the difference between healthy and unhealthy anger, and specifically at what point anger becomes a problem. I'm thinking of someone I used to know many years ago, a highly educated professional in a prominent field, and surface impressions were that this person was kind, funny, willing to step up for friends, you know, all that sort of good stuff, a good guy. And it was only when time passed and they became more comfortable that their anger erupted in truly terrifying ways. At the time, I'd never really met somebody like this before. So initially, I just thought that this was some sort of one-time bad outburst, but then it repeated itself again and again. And so I guess my question is, what is the difference between acute anger and chronic anger? And what's the difference between anger and rage?
Yeah. So let me answer the second question first, the difference between anger and rage. I tend to think of those things as being on a continuum. And I would actually include, although there are some uses of this word that could make it a different category, but I tend to include, you know, mild frustration on one end of that continuum, and then just intense rage on the other end of that continuum, rather than try to sort of parse out those things as separate categories. I just think we're talking about degrees of intensity there. Although that said, I mean, I do think that there are cases where, you know, a person can be so blinded by rage that it really does feel kind of categorically different than some other things. But I think overall, it's sort of best to try and think of it on that continuum. Now, the thing about anger, like the consequences of anger and how we know if a person has an anger problem versus healthy anger, this is the most nuanced and contextual question there is. And I say that because, you know, in some ways, as you were giving that example, this is going to seem a little weird, but I promise I'll get there. But as you were describing that person you knew, I actually, in my mind, one of the things I started thinking about is how we define substance abuse, like how we decide when substance abuse is a problem. Mm-hmm. For a long time, we thought about it purely from the consequences, right? You know, like what is the person, experiencing employment difficulty because of their substance use? Is it causing physical health problems and so on? And that all makes sense in the context of substance abuse, especially when, because one of the things we know is that there are people who barely ever drink, but every time they do, they experience some consequences.
Right.
Which actually in some ways sort of sounded like an example, like, you know, this is a person who didn't get angry very often, but when they did, it was explosive and
destructive.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so it isn't necessarily a frequency issue. It isn't necessarily, like how often it happens. It's the intensity of it when it happens. So here's what makes this really complicated what I tend to think about is, what are the consequences of your anger? Meaning, and I think about those things broadly. So does it lead to problems on the road, as we've been talking about it? Does it lead to interpersonal relationship problems like physical fights or verbal fights or just damaged relationships and all the ways that can happen? Does it lead to substance abuse or overeating or other poor coping strategies? Does it lead to other negative emotions like, feeling depressed afterwards or feeling scared or guilty? Does it lead to property damage or I can't remember if I said physical health problems, but physical health problems, right? Does it lead to those types of things? And if it does, well, then yeah, you've got an anger problem. Here's what makes this complicated and a little bit nuanced though, is that we know that anger can serve some people better than others. And what I mean is, so we've got all sorts of data that says white men who express their anger see positive outcomes. They're seen as more confident. They're seen as more competent. They're seen as better leaders. We know that women who express the exact same anger in the exact same way experience consequences as a result of that. They are seen as less confident. They're seen as less competent. They're seen as worse leaders. We also know that's true for other marginalized groups, right? Black men and Black women are more likely to experience consequences. So sometimes those consequences are not the fault of the angry person. They are the fault of the system that person lives in, the environment that person is experiencing.
Right.
So it's oftentimes a little bit unfair to say that, you know, you are, that these consequences reflect the fact that you have an anger problem, because it might be that person has an environment problem.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because we see that expressed every single day in business, as you mentioned, yep. In our local communities. It doesn't even matter where it is, in politics. I mean, you name it, in the media, this double standard that looks at the group or the identity of somebody and then interprets their behavior based on what group they belong to or what they perceive to be versus purely based on the behavior. So it's right. A lot of that really, really is unfair. But let's say somebody is interested and they're not somebody who is completely off the deep end and suffering enormous problems because of their anger, but they want to learn how to manage this a little bit more effectively. And, you talk about, three questions that everybody can ask themselves to determine if we should be angry and then how angry we should be. And I think those are somewhere along the lines of, was I treated poorly, unfairly, or otherwise wrong? Is someone or something blocking my goals, as you were describing with your driving example? And what might I have done to contribute to this? Can you go a little bit into more detail?
Yeah, you bet. So I think this is really important. And it really comes down to, and this is, again, maybe a little bit of an unpopular opinion, but lately, one of the things that I've been talking about on social media is sort of the validity of emotions, right? And that this idea that our emotions are always valid. And I don't actually think that's true. I think our emotions are always real. I think that they're always, that we should always pay attention to them. We should always acknowledge them. We should always think about them. But I do actually think part of the reason we need to think about them and pay attention to them is to decide, should I be mad, right? Is this in this particular case, right? Should I be feeling angry? And I think in this, you know, to go back to those questions, I think one of the first things that people should ask themselves is, was I actually treated poorly, unfairly, or was I otherwise wronged? And, you know, one of the things you hear often, or I heard often from my kids, especially when they're young, is that's not fair.
Right.
And they get angry. Now, there are lots of times when what was happening was fair. They just didn't like it. And those are two different things. Right. And why I'm bringing this up is because I do think that there are plenty of adults out there who perceive unfair treatment where there is not unfair treatment. It's just they just didn't like the outcome.
Oh,
right?
That is so, so true. Right.
Yeah. And so people need to maybe get a little bit better at determining, is this unfair treatment? Was I actually wronged or am I just disappointed? This might be a place where anger actually is secondary to something else, right? To disappointment or hurt or that kind of frustration. I think being able to critically evaluate those circumstances to decide if you were actively wronged or even passively wronged in a way that was unfair is an important part of this. So the other two questions, the second one is that, is something blocking my goals? And I think this is really important because, and first of all, I think things can block your goals even unintentionally, like things can interfere. And so probably the best example of that is weather, right? Driving someplace or maybe I'm having an outdoor wedding and it rains the day of the wedding and now it's going to interfere with my ability to do this thing that I was excited about or wanted to do. This is a way in which circumstances are blocking your goals. It's nobody's fault, but understandably, people regularly get angry in those circumstances, right? They get angry when weather delays their travel or when weather, and it's not so much that they're being treated unfairly or poorly. They just, something has gotten in the way.
This the is weather. Awful. Yeah, yep. The weather gods conspired against them.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it is interesting how quickly we find someone to blame in those circumstances. I mean, this happens to me. Technology is another place where I think, you know, you're trying to print something and it won't print, right? And so my goal is being blocked, not necessarily in a way that is intentional or focused on me, just happening. And I think it makes sense to be angry or to be frustrated in those circumstances. The third piece is maybe the most complicated, but it is, you know, what might I have done to contribute to this? I believe that human beings have an obligation to explore their own involvement. Anger in particular is interesting because it is a social emotion, meaning we most often experience it in social situations, right? We experience it in interactions with other people and we bring something to those interactions. And so we have an obligation to explore what impact we had on this. And I mean in overt ways, I also mean in subtle ways. I mean, did the facial expression, did the way I approach this interaction bring out hostility? Did I say something that led to hostility? This isn't about victim blaming, and I don't want anyone to hear that. I think it's about having a sort of nuanced understanding of who we are in the world and how we might influence people. And if I go into a restaurant and for whatever reason, I'm feeling a little bit hostile and that message comes through to the server and then they treat me poorly in response. Well, I'm not saying I earned poor treatment so much as I'm saying I played a role there. That how I behaved in that moment brought some poor treatment back to me. And I should pay attention to that.
Yeah, no, those are really good real life examples that a lot of us experience. And I do want to point out that in the entire last chapter of your first book, you talk about using anger constructively, suggesting that we think of it as fuel that gives us the energy and power necessary to change things that need changing and solve problems that need solving. Can you give us some examples of some of these pressing things that are out there where anger is justified, anger expressed in a way that is conducive to change, not destructive? And I'm sure there's a long list, but just throw a couple out there.
Yeah. So I guess the thing that I think is really important for people to, and this is where that context matters so much, is, you know, ultimately when you're angry, one of the reasons you're angry is because there's some sort of problem in your life, or some sort of, and I'm defining problem broadly, like something has gone wrong. And so a way of thinking about this is thinking about, okay, so how can I channel my anger into solving that problem? Now, that problem can be really small, really simple. You know, I use the printer example. You know, if this is happening to you regularly, well, fix your printer, right? I mean, that's a way of channeling that anger into this frustrating thing. Or these problems can be huge, right? One of the things that I'm hearing a lot, especially from young people right now, is that there's a great deal of sadness and fear and anger over climate change, and real intense feelings of frustration there. And so now it is not possible for an individual to solve that crisis, but individuals can play a role in solving that crisis. And so potentially channeling anger into things like that can be really, really, can be a valuable way of handling it.
We talked about some of the gender differences or group differences in how people can express anger. But I want to specifically talk about the cultural acceptance of anger, namely, whether anger is accepted more in some cultures compared to others, and related to that, whether certain expressions of anger by some cultures or subgroups are viewed differently.
It's really interesting. One of the ways to think about this is the degree to which a culture or a community sort of values group or cohesion, right? So the degree to which people are comfortable expressing particular emotions really is rooted in part in the degree to which a culture sort of accepts the idea, or sometimes there's this thing of, a culture, and this could be true of subgroups as well, is, well, do we suppress the emotion for the good of the group, right? Meaning we want to maintain group harmony, and maintaining group harmony might mean that person A or B needs to suppress their feelings of anger, suppress their feelings of sadness for the good of the group. Now, you see that sometimes in cultures that have more of a sort of collective identity versus more of an individual that value more individualism. And the United States has a tendency to really value individual freedom and individual identity. And so you're more likely to see some of those outward expressions of emotions, particularly anger here, than you would be in some other cultures. And that's going to, even within the United States or within a culture, there's going to be different norms around that, right? So this is where, and I'm not familiar with any research that's looked at this, these types of differences, but you might see particular regions of the country where particular types of anger expression are more welcome than elsewhere. And it's rooted in a lot of different phenomena, but one of them is that sort of collectivism versus individualism.
Yeah, definitely. And we touched on the idea of our values and our beliefs and how they impact what we view as something that justifies our anger. And I'm wondering if you can touch on the process that you wrote about in one of your books that talks about how to better understand what these values and beliefs are and how they drive our anger formation.
Yeah. So, you know, all of us have sort of an operating system of that we might call our like worldview, like how we see the world, how we see ourselves, and ultimately how we see ourselves operating in the world. And And I don't think this is something that we're like thinking of top of mind all the time, but it's something that sort of influences how we engage with people. And that worldview influences us in all these very specific ways, one of which is how do I react when I'm angry? And so if your worldview, for instance, is, well, no, I believe people should be treated with kindness all the time. Well, in those circumstances, when you get angry, you aren't going to take it out on other people the way the way someone else might, because no, this is my worldview. People need to be treated with kindness all the time. And so even if I'm mad, I sacrifice my own feelings instead of harming someone else. Whereas another person's value system might be very different. Another person might sort of come from a perspective of, well, no, I put myself first. And because I put myself first, when I'm angry, I do take it out on other people. And I'm using extremes, but ultimately, you know, there's all of this is where a lot of that nuance comes in. And so, and our worldviews if this is sort of how we operate on this sort of core level, what it plays itself out in some of the specific thoughts we have in a particular moment. If we put ourselves first in most circumstances, well, then in that example I gave earlier where I was, a car slowed me down, well, I might gravitate towards hostility towards that person because their action slowed me down and now I'm upset. If I gravitate towards kindness, well, then my interpretation of what happened might be much more positive, might be much more sort of understanding.
So, you know, we started this by talking about beliefs and values, and it seems like we're now talking a little bit about temperament, right? So are some people more inclined to be angry than others based on temperament? Is this a question of innate qualities, or is a question of upbringing or prior negative experiences, or what?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. And so I think that, temperament is one of those words that I think has a very specific meaning in psychology that oftentimes refers to, newborns or young children. But I think as we're defining it here, we're talking more about just sort of personality style and,
right.
and how. And I think that from a personality perspective, there are people who have a quote unquote angry personality. Right, that are just angrier than other people, and we've this has been found in a number of different studies. They get angry more frequently. They find more mild provocations to be more provoking. So their anger is more intense, and they're actually more likely to express that anger in like hostile, aggressive ways. However, I guess to answer the question, where does it come from? What we see is a couple different places. Like anything, it's a combination of some genetic predispositions, right? It's a combination of, anger does tend to, quote unquote, run in families. And that's even found to be true when we look at like adoption studies or twin studies, so that we're able to tease out some of the upbringing side. But ultimately, the upbringing is really, really important. And it's important in a couple different ways, right? It's important from a modeling perspective, right? What we tend to do, what we see. And so if our caregivers were really hostile or aggressive or in their anger expression, then we are likely to be. It's also, though, relevant from a what were we punished for? How were we punished? What were we scolded for, right? Did I get in trouble for swearing when I was a kid? And maybe that's different than another kid who doesn't get in trouble for that. And so might do it more readily or might do it in some circumstances. And like all of those things end up playing a role. What was encouraged is when I was mad, was I encouraged to go to my room and hit stuff? Or when I was mad, did we talk it through? So all of those things really matter when it comes to how that angry personality is formed.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I also think of how expression is supported or not supported. And I'm thinking of people who might have some to their own detriment, some really harmful behaviors, very concerning and sad behaviors. We're talking about eating disorders, certainly drug use, but eating disorders, cutting, things like that.
Those types of behaviors that you're describing have a host of emotional correlates, right? That they come from a lot of different places. And so, like, we'll just use, self-harm or cutting as an example, right? I mean, that is rooted in deep sadness. It's rooted in real intense anger. It's rooted in feeling misunderstood or even hopeless and helpless and all these things. And so I think oftentimes you're absolutely right. When a person has those types of complicated feelings, they end up turning them, they sometimes end up turning them on themselves for the exact reason you described, that, like, well, there is no outlet out there. There's no one I can go to that understands. There aren't people I can talk to. And so I turn this in on myself because it's a thing that helps me feel better. I think that this speaks to the importance of people in general, but, you know, oftentimes the behaviors we're talking about are with kids. It speaks to the importance of them having an understanding human in their life that they can share their feelings with in a way that doesn't feel judgmental, in a way that doesn't feel, hurt, additionally bad to them.
I don't know if this goes beyond the scope of your work, but are there historical periods where anger, in terms of how parents react to children's general anger and frustrations and those big emotions that everybody carries, more productively or society does, or is that something that we don't see go through historical periods?
Yeah, I think it's probably undeniable that we do see historical periods where there are shifts in thinking around those things. I think, and I would argue, like, right now we're in a moment where I think parents are becoming much more attuned to children's emotions and what children are capable of than we were even 10 years ago. And I think, you know, so much social talk, you see it on social media, you see articles about it, you see it all these places, so much talk about sort of gentle parenting and things like that, that's really rooted in the idea that kids are having big feelings and that part of our job is to help them learn to navigate those. And I very much agree with that approach. Obviously the devil's in the details as far as what it looks like.
And right.
To be honest, when it comes to children, I actually think most of what we describe as, like, a behavior problem is actually an emotion problem, right? That it's, those behaviors are driven by something, and typically they're being driven by emotions and not knowing the healthiest ways to deal with those things.
Let's assume that somebody is feeling a lot of anger and they're concerned about that. At what point should they sit there and say, well, wait a minute, maybe I want to go to therapy because of it? And then you're probably going to say, you know, it depends on what type of anger, how it's expressed, yeah, and so forth. But how are they going to know when is the right time to pursue therapy?
Yeah, I think that's where I would start, is to say, look, if you are experiencing anger that feels detrimental to you or to your loved ones, and with anger, that's a particular important caveat. I'm going to even take a moment to say about that. You have to be aware of the fact that your anger might be affecting your loved ones in ways that you don't even realize. And what I think is really important there is, you know, a lot of times I'll hear from angry people who will say, well, I never take it out on them. I never yell at my kids. I never yell at my spouse. And that's great. But if they hear you yell, especially your kids, it's still scary to them, right? I mean, if you're angry a lot, it might be causing a rift in your relationship with your children or with your spouse because they find that anger frightening, even if that anger isn't directed at them. Or they might frankly find it unsafe, right? They might find it, scary because, hey, you could get in a fight with someone. So or you could, you know, have a problem on the road. And so I think that's something to be thinking about. So if you're having problems connected to your anger, then I think and you haven't been successful in dealing with those problems on your own. And that's a little bit, in some ways that doesn't necessarily matter because from my perspective, if you want therapy and you can afford therapy and therapy is accessible to you, then why not go?
Right? Oh, yeah.
And then the therapist can tell you how much you need. That's an important thing to think about. I think that, you know, how you can kind of help make that decision for yourself is a question about sort of what have I tried? What has worked? What hasn't worked? How can I, you know, I hear people oftentimes say, well, you know, part of the reason that they go to therapy is because they otherwise didn't necessarily know where to start. You know, that they thought, I have this anger problem. I haven't really tried to solve it on my own. And that's because I don't really know what to do. And so therapy might be a good option for someone like that. As far as the types of therapy that I would focus on, I personally tend to come from a cognitive behavioral school of thought. That is really what that, you know, my first book in particular is rooted in, is this idea that our thoughts are influencing our feelings. And so we need to pay attention to the thoughts we're having. All the worldview stuff we've been talking about is really rooted in that. That tends to be what I support. I will tell people to be really, really careful from the perspective that a thing that therapists advocate quite a bit is that does not work and that we have no data to support is catharsis, meaning the outward physical expression of anger as a way of quote unquote releasing rage. And so if you've got a therapist who's saying, hey, go punch a punching bag or go punch a pillow or tear up phone books or go to a rage room, that's probably not someone you should either keep seeing or you may want to, I don't know how you want to handle that, but those approaches don't work and you should find other ways. And I can unpack that further if you want, but those approaches aren't healthy. So a year ago, I took down a loft from my son's bedroom, right? He had a loft in there and he'd kind of outgrown it. So we took it down and that meant we had a bunch of lumber we had to get rid of. And so I took a load to the dump and, you know, here I am, anger researcher who's long said, you know, rage rooms are bad. Don't do that. And at one point I just took like a board and I threw it as far as I could. And it, I will admit for a moment, I had this moment where I was like, that was deeply satisfying. Right? That felt really good. Like to just sort of consequence free environment, just do something a little bit destructive. And the thing is, so I get it. I understand why people like going to rage rooms. I understand why people are interested in that. I've actually had some people, when I've talked about this on social media, I've had a few people reach out to me and say, is it okay if I just go because it's fun? And, you know, it's not for me. Like I will be honest that I find something kind of gross about them. Like the destruction of stuff.
Right. If that's the one thing you like to do and that's the biggest fun, it's like destroying or taking things down. Maybe you should talk to a therapist about some of the underlying motivations there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, it's like, you know, in a world that is already, we're overproducing, like it's kind of gross. But that said, that is different. It is different to say, hey, I do this because it's kind of fun sometimes. That's different than saying I do this to work out my anger and this is how I work out my anger. The former, I don't know, the former probably isn't great for you either if you do it too often, but the latter is definitely destructive. There was a running kind of joke, sort of half joke in my family of the quote unquote Martin temper. Which was that the people in my family, especially the males in my family, were quick to get angry. You know, and that started with my dad, who as I mentioned in the book, was a really angry guy. And, you know, interesting kind of in the example I used before, didn't regularly get angry with me. And you know, but would would be likely to snap at, say, a waiter or a waitress or another driver or something like that. And he was angry from that perspective. Sounds like he was also, I didn't know him in this context, but really like pretty angry at work too. And I think, you know, that definitely did serve as one of the things that got me really interested in that. I grew up with this emotion. And I think one of the things that I found really interesting about it is that despite this emotion being sort of omnipresent in my childhood and in my family, there was no lack of love there, right? Like we were a very loving family. I have great relationships with my siblings and my mom. Like we're all really close, you know. And so it wasn't in fact, the anger was very rarely taken out on each other. So I think sometimes when people hear me talk about that, they assume that my childhood was in some way unpleasant. And that isn't really the case. It was just that this emotion was sort of regular and present. The other thing I would say is that when I did as a kid suffer some consequences as a result of my anger, that I was not a very good student. I was a pretty emotional kid when I was in high school in particular, easily frustrated, easily hurt, in ways that it, like I do think that I every now and then sort of suffered some consequences because of that. I also, when I was in college, I worked at a shelter for at-risk kids. I preface this by saying these kids had a great deal to be angry about, and I understand where this anger came from for so many of them. Mm-hmm. But it was, this anger was really causing them problems, that it was part of the clinical picture for all of them, or most of them, was not knowing how to express it, not having a lot to be angry about, and having been treated poorly, but not being able to manage that anger effectively. And so when I went to graduate school, it was kind of all of those different things coming together to say, well, this is something I want to spend some more time thinking about.
Yeah. So you mentioned your family. And so I'm thinking in a family where anger is intertwined with love, mm-hmm. how do people separate those two and try to avoid ending up with somebody who has a tendency towards being angry a lot because that's what they're used to?
Right. Yeah, I mean, some of this kind of dovetails into some relationship areas that I know a little bit less about. But I'll just say, you know, I think one of the things that's really important in relationships of any kind is that people are able to communicate with each other effectively and in a way that people are receptive to. And there are relationships where those dynamics can play out really well, even when there's anger expressed, because that's what people are comfortable with, whether that's how they grew up or whatever. I think that the other side of it too is people being able to adjust when that communication style isn't working. Right. So if a person can say, hey, you know what, you snap at me and it makes me shut down, or I shut down after that, that the person can hear that and can make adjustments. I think that's another piece of this as well. And too often, I think there's sort of two parts of this. One is too often that those communication styles don't match. But then the second problem is they don't match and neither person can really adjust to try and communicate more effectively. If there was a thing that I want for everyone that's even broader than just anger, is for people to have that sort of emotional literacy, right? So how do I understand emotions in the world? How do I recognize the way in which my emotions connect to the emotions of someone else, the way they influence my behavior, the way that then influences other people's behavior toward me? This is a complicated and really nuanced, thoughtful thing that a lot of times people just don't pay attention to or haven't really been taught to pay attention to.
Yeah, and that's why I find your work so important, and I hope as many people as possible listen to this podcast. And that's why I want people to know how they can follow your work and how they can read your books, your two books out there.
Yeah, so I do. I have two books that are available wherever you buy your books. You mentioned them earlier, but it's Why We Get Mad and How to Deal with Angry People, those two. There's actually a third on the way called Emotion Hacks, but not sure when it'll be out, but a little bit broader than anger this time around. The other thing that people can do is follow me on social media. I'm on, I'm pretty much in all of the places. It's at Anger Professor. TikTok, Instagram, those are my two biggest, but also, you know, Facebook, Threads, LinkedIn, all the different spots. I feel like I forgot some there as I was talking through it, but I can't remember. I am on Twitter, but I don't spend a ton of time on Twitter.
Yeah. So you really are all over the place.
Yeah. I try to be.
That's fantastic. And to all the listeners out there, if you enjoyed today's conversation with Dr. Ryan Martin and want to know when new episodes of the Ready Living Podcast are released, send an email with the subject line podcast to team@readywhenstuffhappens.com, and I'll make sure you're notified the minute they're available. And finally, Ryan, thank you so, so very much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me. And I love the idea of this podcast, by the way. I think it's a great concept. And so this is really cool. And I'm really thankful to have had the chance to talk with you.